What we're talking about is late night and early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers into the afternoon. With variable high cloudiness, gusty winds at times around that corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold blood. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health and the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerting, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Cold on the ticket taker smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon except for kind of a lone gust of wind in the bedroom.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connection. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is Wednesday. It is the 8th day of February. Boy, these months are going by faster than I thought. And, you know, we've been talking with a lot of researchers over the last few weeks and even months. Last night with Eustace Mullins, and last week we had a researcher named Christopher on a couple of occasions. And we're always trying to move the ball forward in the area of research. And so I've been looking for people who are capable and educated enough to speak on some of the subjects that are important to all of us. One of the subjects that I have been actually pounding pretty hard on the radio about is this new book. Well, it's not a new book, but to me it was quite new. Most of these subjects are new to me. It's a book called The 13th Tribe by a man named Kossler, and it was written some time ago. However, it is still, to date, I think probably the strongest evidence we've got of some of the deceptions around, you know, the Zionist camp, how they are going out into the air, you know, airwaves and into the newspapers, creating false charges of anti-Semitism, causing people to believe that they are in fact the rightful heirs to Israel and many other things, and so I've invited someone from Britain. His name is Mohammed Refik, and he has been involved in trying to get the truth out about this stuff for over a decade and a half, going on 2 decades now, which is amazing because, you know, this is back in the day when nobody was talking about this, or very few people. And so I'm going to invite him up right now. Mohammed, are you with me?
I am indeed, Daryl. How are you?
It's wonderful to have you on the French Connection. You know, I want you, first of all, to understand that we are probably going to be going out to between 10 and 15,000 people. It is quite an audience. They're extremely well-educated, so you don't have to even do some of the base work, because most of the people that are going to be listening today already know the basic story. What we're going to try to do today, I think, is, and the best thing we could do, is kind of color in the gray areas with some facts. And I think the first thing I'd like to start out with is how this Khazarian empire was born, and because the listeners they already know that the Khazars are the forerunners to the Ashkenazi sect of Judaism. So, since you've done the study, where did the Khazar dynasty begin, and how did it get underway?
As with a lot of these things, Daryl, you'll find that there is more than one version of events, and the traditional version and the correct understanding is the understanding given in Arthur Koestler's book, The 13th Tribe. I think his book, if anybody wanted to study it in detail, would be a good starting point. What we'll do is we'll cover both sides of it, I think. We'll cover what the correct version is and then what the disinformation people are putting out. Mm-hmm. And also look at why, right in the end, I think, why they're putting disinformation on the subject.
Okay.
Well, what actually happened was, somewhere between the 7th and 8th centuries of the Christian era, we find these Khazars who live in the area which was named after them, Khazaria, which is the land locked between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. The northern border of this land is actually the third range of mountains. Between, if you were to start heading north from the south, you'll find there's actually three ranges of mountains, and the third one being the Caucasus up there, just
yep.
north of which is where modern-day Chechnya and Ingushetia are.
Okay.
And to the south, you would find the main trade route that came out through Persia across northern Iraq, northern Syria, and into Turkey. This was a common...
Is that the Kurdish, present Kurdistan region? Don't we have a lot of Kurds in that area?
It would include Kurdistan and possibly Azerbaijan, and slightly out to the north even would stretch up to southern Armenia.
And he does provide a pretty decent map on the website, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to follow along, you could go to the French Connection website. The book is available on the site, and you'd be able to see the map that Muhammad is referring to.
Now, the fact that it's between the land of the Khazars is as you go over the first range of mountains and drop down, their empire stretched from the north side of the first range of mountains all the way to the south side of the third. This area is modern-day Georgia. Covers a lot of the land in modern-day Georgia. What's important about it is that because they basically had a range of mountains to the north, a range to the south, seas on the east and the west, they remained stable there for a very long time. And it was around the 7th and 8th centuries that they found themselves for the first time facing a difficult situation, in that the Byzantine Empire, which was modern-day Turkey, was trying to stop the expanding Muslim Empire coming out of Arabia, which it had already reached up through Palestine and into Syria and obviously out into...
And he refers to it as the Caliphs.
The Caliph is the leader. He's the Muslim leader.
Right, and he said that the Caliphs from the south were making many, many attacks over the many centuries into his southern flank.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And what he wanted to do, as I say, this is the first area that there are two versions of. What he wanted to do was find a political way out of the situation, because he knew he was under pressure, and that if he embraced Christianity, because at this time they were idolaters, they followed some form of idol worship, and they knew if they aligned themselves with the Christians, they'd have in Byzantium, they'd have to become Christian, and they would find themselves then at war with the Muslims.
Right.
And if they embraced Islam, they would find themselves in a situation where they would be at war with the Byzantines.
And now I'm going to stop you, because those two things are very, I think, important concepts. But the third thing I want to say is that he had a trading public living in many of his cities that were from the Jewish community, international traders, people that were able to trade between Islam and Christianity, unencumbered, basically. And he already had a pretty decent Jewish community living there at this time, didn't he?
Well, no, actually, he had a very small Jewish community compared to the size of his whole nation. But the Jews obviously were transacting business along the east-west trade route.
Right.
And what would happen is that people wishing to sell goods north into Russia and all the Slavic states, they maintain sovereignty over that. So anybody wanting to do business north, or for that matter coming from the north and do business south through the Caucasus, they had to do it through him. So the Jews were like any other group of traders. They were present and they tried to remain on good terms with him. The Kagan, as he was known, the king of the Khazars. Anyway, he found himself in this difficult political situation, and he knew about Judaism, obviously, because he had contact with them. And he asked his advisors, how are we going to get out of this political dilemma? What are we going to do that will leave me in charge of this nation? I mean, I don't have to submit to either the powers of Christianity, the Vatican, or the Caliph. What can I do? And then he was given the idea of, why don't we embrace Judaism? Because the Jews are respected and the practitioners of Judaism are respected by both Christians and Muslims. If we embrace Judaism, you will be able to stay in power. Neither of them will attack you through reverence, and they will respect you, and you do not have to give allegiance either way. Now, that is the formally understood way in which he decided to go that way forward. I must point out that in Jewish books, most notably Yehuda Halevi, who was a 12th century Jewish philosopher based in Toledo in Spain, he wrote a book which is seen as one of the great classics in Jewish literature, which deals with the subject of Judaism as a religion versus Christianity versus Islam as the three monotheistic faiths, and how that becomes a dialogue between rabbis, priests, bishops, and Muslim scholars, and that the king of the Khazars had been given dreams where he was told by God to find God through a faith. So the Jewish understanding of this event is comes more from Yehuda Halevi's work, one where they say that the king of the Khazars was inspired to find God through this dream that he'd been having.
So there is no conflict in the Jewish community as to a conversion to Judaism, rather than them being one of the original Israelite tribes, one of the tribes that wandered out of the Holy Land 1,000 years earlier.
Well, there is no doubt whatsoever with inside of Judaism, with inside of Encyclopedia Judaica, you will find if you look up the term Ashkenazim as opposed to Sephardim. With inside the Jewish community, this is very well known. Two types of Jew, the Sephardic, those who are descendants of the diaspora, the true diaspora, who spread across North Africa and eventually made their way into Muslim Spain, and the Ashkenazim, who are referred to as descendants of the Khazars. What happened was that when Arthur Koestler published his book, which is a very well-researched piece of archaeology and history, there was an immediate knee-jerk reaction, and he became very hated for it within the Jewish community. Because although the Jews themselves are very aware of this, it's not something they like publicized for reasons that will become very obvious.
Yeah.
Now, what then happens is that another one of the claims which Jews today try to say about this conversion is that this conversion was something which was done by the king alone, the Kagan, and a few notables from the royal family.
Right.
So they try to say, hey, this wasn't en masse, this was not large scale. Again, it flies in the face of historians. We have Christian of Stavelot in 864, stating that all seven tribes had embraced Judaism, of the Khazars. And all the early historians up to the 10th century, they say things like, the Khazars and their king are all Jews. All of the Khazars are Jews, but they have been Judaized recently. This is even among the Muslim historians, the Jewish historians, the authentic historians of the day all say, no, this was a mass conversion. And evidence to prove that from an archaeological perspective has now been uncovered within the last decade, actually, Darrell, whereby they've found that there was a change in the entire burial procedure of the Khazar people. All of the amulets and things related to their pagan idolatry ceased to be there. And instead we find religious symbolism and them being buried with their heads, I think it is, in the direction of Jerusalem and so on. So it's now recognized that it was a sweeping change across the whole of Khazaria, that en masse, over a 200-year period, they were entirely converted to Judaism, to the extent that by the time we reach the 10th century, Hebrew has become their written script, and they are fluent in Hebrew, Aramaic, and their native tongue, which was a Turkic tongue. And they were actually Turkic.
Now, I understand. See, now here's the interesting thing that starts developing here. We've got haunting marauders coming down out of the Russian region called the Rus, and they would make, you know, every summer they would make their southern forays into areas around Khazaria and more over time into Khazaria. And there was pressure coming from the east as well, as the centuries moved forward from the Mongols, including, finally, Genghis Khan and his group. So there was a great deal of pressure being placed on his middle kingdom, around the 11th century, and, it started, eroding the Khagan's, power, and I understand that there was an exodus of some of them during that period. One of them went to an area in Hungary, according to the book. They were called Kobar Khazars. And they were a Jewish group of Kobar Khazars that moved into the Hungarian region. And I'm wondering if this starts showing that, you know, the Khazarian group starting to fray at the edges, the control points.
Well, there are two sides. That's a very good point, Darrell. There are two sides to this. One is that if we bear in mind that during this sort of time in which they have monopolized the trade routes north into Europe and the Slavic areas, obviously they're embracing Judaism, caused many people to be aware of that throughout the whole of Europe, and for them as Khazars, wherever they went, they became more recognizable than they previously were. When it comes to them stretching out as far as Hungary, through research which is more modern than just the 13th tribe, we find that these people had made their way to Kiev.
Right.
They were in many, many other towns throughout the area. We would find them in Pera, in a suburb of Constantinople.
Yeah.
They were in Phanagoria. They were in so many different places.
Now, did they make it north far enough at this moment in the 11th century as far as, wasn't there a little ghetto enclave of this group in like Latvia and Estonia starting to form around 11th, 12th century?
They were actually there before then. They were in Latvia, they were in Poland, they were in the Crimea. They were in Moravia, Croatia, Croatia, all of these areas that they'd actually made their way into. I have a quote here from the Jewish Journal of Sociology, 1962. It says that Polish scholars agree that the oldest Polish-Jewish settlements were founded by Jewish emigres from the Khazar state and Russia.
Right.
While the Jews from southern and western Europe only began to arrive later. Some people, they start to say, okay, we'll accept that Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria and all the Jews of the Slavic states may have been from the Khazars, but they say, but we don't believe this for Poland. We don't accept this for Poland. Polish Jews were Sephardic, not Ashkenazi. But of course that turns out, as that quote that I've just given there from 1962 makes it clear, the original settlements, Jewish settlements in Poland, were again founded by the Khazars, or Ashkenazi.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd come all the way that far west.
Now that also, there is a body type to each race that we know of. I mean, if you look at Irish, you can see the Norse in there, and you can see a lot of their specific traits of being Irish. Well, the same holds true with the Khazars. They were a willowy kind of lighter skinned, and in some cases, their northern part of their country actually had light colored eyes in some instances, blue and even green and gray eyes, and they had like ashy light skin. They were not in any way looking like they had mixed with southern stock from, like, let's say, the Turkish area. And so there was actually some very reasonable eye proof. In other words, you look at somebody from a certain group, you can tell people are Chinese or they're Korean or not at all the time, but as a group, it's reasonably easy to see if you come from a Semitic background or you come from a Slavic or a Pseudo-Slavic background. And my point being is that many of the Jews that lived in Poland have no resemblance whatsoever to any Semitic tribes.
Indeed. And it's very important that you're stating that they don't appear Semitic. One of the claims, one of the disinformation claims about the Khazars is that they were originally descendants from the 12 tribes. That they were made up from, say, the lost 10 tribes, or and so on, and all sorts of the strange, weird claims, or they were, you know, with Moses but wandered off in Arabia. This is absolute nonsense. The Khazar people had been in that special area of landlocked flatlands for almost 2,000 years. By the time they began to emigrate en masse in the 10th and 11th centuries, and by the 13th century Christian era they'd left, they had been there 2,000 years now. Their time, this group had been there since the time of the ancient world Hittite kingdom, which was a kingdom that spread across the whole of Turkey all the way to Armenia and north. That was from the ancient world, when there was ancient Babylon and ancient Egypt. The other third big empire of that time in that part of the world were the Hittites. And the Hittites were a Turkic people. And what's crucial is that the Khazar tribes lived under the kingship of the Hittite king.
Okay. So now, the point I want to get to now, I think, because I want to roll this forward, because the filler that we need, that the listeners need, is in the book, and further research that can be gleaned from their own efforts. But the point I wanted to make of all this is that the claim has been made that if I criticize someone who practices the Jewish faith, I can be charged with anti-Semitism. Now that on its on the face of it would be true if all the Jews were Semites, and you could juxtapose my critique into their national origin or their racial and ethnic origins. But that, on its face, is also a false statement, because these people are not of Semitic background, according to anthropological study. Am I correct in making that assertion?
Indeed. The anthropological evidence is unequivocal. They were a Turkic people, and a set of tribes who, whilst as tribes, even before their embracing Judaism, would intermarry among themselves, very rarely married outside of the Khazari nation. And this became even more strong as a social behavior and social pattern after they had embraced Judaism, because, of course, they began to view the rest of the world as Gentile, because they sent to parts of the Jewish world, like Babylonia and Toledo, and asked for scholars,
mm-hmm.
and synagogues to be erected, and for books, and began studying this faith. Which
now, there was something interesting you told me. You told me something quite interesting. Because they did not fit into Scripture in some instances, especially about being the Israelite group, they began maybe a movement toward the Babylonian Talmudic and not Torah tradition, and this is where the Zohar and the Kabbalistic tradition is stronger within the Ashkenazi elite than in some of the other groups within Judaism.
Indeed, when we look at the practical side of the way that these people practice their beliefs, we find a difference emerging very early on. I would like to say that somebody who was a contemporary of Yehuda Halevi in Toledo in Spain was a man called Abraham Ben David, or Ben Dawood as he's sometimes known.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a book which he wrote in the 12th century called Exalted Religion, and saying that he was not a philosopher, by the way, he was an interpreter of law, as was Maimonides. And he said that that although Judaism itself is a reasonable religion, he said on physiological grounds, the non-Jew who is converted to Judaism is therefore not quite on a par with the born Jew. So we find here, within inside this Sephardic community, as they're now known as Sephardi, where they're looking at these people embracing Judaism and saying, well, they're coming in to practice our laws and our teachings, but we don't think they're the same as us. Now, Maimonides himself actually didn't agree with that opinion, but the fact of the matter is that a large number of Sephardi did believe in that and refused to allow their daughters and sons to intermarry with Ashkenazi. Once these Ashkenazi realized, oh, hang on a minute, we're being ostracized here because of something in the teachings. And that something in the teachings is the reference to the house of Israel, or the children of Israel. And this is going to become very important when we discuss this in more detail in a few minutes now. The fact of the matter is, the Gentile can embrace Judaism, and he is a Jew by virtue of what he's practicing. This is what the Sephardi were saying.
Right.
But they are not the house of Israel. They are not descendants of the house of Israel. They do not come from the 12 tribes. And therefore, we 12, as members of the 12 tribes, remain separated from them.
Now, wasn't there a period in the 1st and 2nd centuries where Judaism, even under the Sephardi, were a proselytizing religion, where they did openly seek converts to Judaism when they made their travels?
Indeed. I mean, with the argument of why, from a biblical perspective, God is supposed to have chosen the children of Israel, they were not chosen because they were particularly special or clever or something. They were chosen to deliver his message, so to the world, to go out there and proclaim it for everybody and make it available for everybody. So we believe that's what they should have been doing. And it did happen on occasion. And according to a professor friend, F-R-E-N-D,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a history of the early church, he's one of the great historians of the early church here in England, he points out that during the first century of the Christian era, actually more people, Romans and Greeks that is, were embracing Judaism than Christianity. Judaism actually spread faster during the first century.
Now, so my point is then that not only are they, that many Jews in that first century were not Semites either, they might have been Greeks or even Roman, or might have been even Berber or other tribal groups that were converted during the travels of these proselytizing groups of Jews. So the fact is, even the Sephardic group cannot claim pure bloodline all the way back to Israel in any pure sense.
No, definitely not. I mean, the scale, obviously, of people within Sephardi not belonging to the 12 tribes is obviously much smaller. I mean, to put this in context, in modern world Jewry, and this is very important for the listeners, over 80%, some say as much as 90%, so I will settle on 85 if that's okay with you tonight.
Okay, yeah.
85% of world Jewry today are Ashkenazi. This is not small stuff. We're saying the majority of Jews in the world today, people who are called Jews, are Ashkenazi. And as we've been demonstrating, the we have, for instance, at the time that the records state that the empire fell, the Khazar Empire fell, they said there were at least 30,000 practicing Ashkenazi Jews who made their way north at that time into parts of Russia which they'd become friendly with because they'd done were doing trade, and had even already expanded out to places like in Kiev, like in Hungary, like in Poland. It became safe for them. What was also interesting was that when the Inquisition began in the 15th century, and Jews found themselves having to leave Europe very quickly, the majority of them went south through Spain into Morocco, and that's
right.
Why there was a very large Sephardic community in Morocco. Another number of them did travel north into Poland, but it's believed that because of these difficulties between somebody being Sephardic and somebody being Ashkenazi, the fact that the Jews themselves have been very well aware of this, and the fact that intermarriage between the two groups became prohibited. And coming back to your point earlier, Darrell, the Ashkenazi started looking at Judaism not so much with the emphasis on the Torah, but looking more to the Talmud, because the Torah, the Old Testament, places a lot of emphasis on the tribes of Israel.
Right.
Whereas the Talmud opened up doors for them as converts to Judaism.
So they began a tradition of what we call rabbinical Judaism, didn't they?
Yes.
And that rabbinical Judaism, for people who are not aware of what that means that much of the traditions are handed down through the rabbis and written down by the rabbis, and that the rabbis themselves are the definers of the religion. They define it over time, and within the Ashkenazi sect, that defining of the religion is much more prevalent than what you would find in the Sephardic side.
It certainly was at that point in history, and
mm-hmm.
it remained that way for quite a few centuries. That's true, now, absolutely. And,
mm-hmm.
and so for Sephardic Jews, their home was the Torah, and they would use the other books, especially the Talmud, as commentary. What happened with the Ashkenazi is that they found themselves becoming experts in the Talmud and asking Talmudic experts to come to them and pushing the Torah to one side, till eventually some among the Ashkenazi even began to deny the Torah. They refused to accept it and said, our two books are the Talmud And the Zohar, the commentary on the Talmud, it reached such a stage that...
because they were being excluded from much of the prophecy that was guaranteed them in the Torah, so they felt maybe that they were not being fairly graced by God in those particular books. So they chose to go to the place that was going to give them the best deal.
Exactly. Mm. And also, what was important from the perspective of the monarchy of the Khazars was that they had a vested interest in making sure that happened, because when they brought all of these Jewish scholars in and the people became Jews and studied their Judaism under them, he wanted to make sure that he had a spin on the Judaism which left him as king and left them as loyal subjects to him, and not subjects to, some rabbi in some far distant land. So he had to, it was also he had a political reason for making sure that they saw him in a light which was above that their own position, that is to say the rabbis.
Now I want to talk about two groups that came out of both Sephardism and Ashkenazism. What we've got up in the north is a migration into the ghettos, and the reason they ghettoized their society was to keep their group cohesive, because they felt that as soon as they began to move into the general population, there was a watering down of their faithful, and as a result of that, they would have a loss of their community power and the strength of their, maybe their future strength within the community. So what we've got growing out of that region is certain movements. One of them was a Frankist movement, and another one was being run by groups of Kabbalistic practicing Kabbalists for the most part, who also wanted the community to stay closely together. And they demanded tithes from these people in order to keep a power base that was structured at the top. The reason I'm getting to that is because there was great fortunes that were handed over to certain groups within this dynasty that gave birth to the things such as the Rothschild fortunes and so forth. So I want to talk about the movement in the northern European areas of Lithuania and Latvia and even the area of Lubavitch, in fact, because that's one city that was a very large concentration of Jewish rabbinical scholars. Do you have information on those things?
Well, that's kind of fast-forwarding a little bit down the centuries. And I want to finish with this, because this statement here is very important in terms of why the Khazars also maintain their own identity. I'm going to quote now from Heiko Hallmann, A History of East European Jews. He says, apparently, part of the Khazar Jews remained in their areas of settlement, like you were saying, in Hungary, Latvia, Slovenia, Croatia, all of these parts of Russia and Kiev. They remained in their areas of settlement because there is evidence of a messianic movement among the Jewish Khazars of the Crimea.
Yeah.
So what had basically happened was that a lot of the Ashkenazi Jews at this stage, practices of Judaism, had a messianic movement forming in the Crimea. Now, to understand how important the Messiah is, you've got to remember that all Jews and practices of Judaism and the tribes of Israel are all messianic, in that they are awaiting the end of this diaspora. They're waiting for salvation. They believe that the Messiah will come, and when he does, he will lead them in a new kingdom, starting from which will be in Jerusalem, and his throne will be in Jerusalem, and he will rule the world from there. And this is prophecy which all Jews believe in, no matter what their sect of Judaism. And of course, what we've got here is that in the 11th and 12th centuries, in the area of the Crimea, we have a messianic movement. And the reason there's a messianic movement is that the king of the Khazars himself had a semi-messianic position, because he was, you know, a king. He commanded mighty armies. He was in charge of huge parts of the world, and he was a Jew. So their view was, hey, this guy's, you know, the progenitor of the man who's going to sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And so one of the things that the Ashkenazi became very noticeable for was their tendency not only for practicing Talmud and getting deeply into Kabbalah, but also this messianism. Whereas when we look at the Sephardi view is God has thrown us out of Jerusalem and the land of Israel. We've been thrown out of there, and we have to wait for him to ask us to come back, because God has said we're not allowed to return until he says so. Now, this is where we see political Zionism, if you like, starting to manifest.
Because in just by virtue of this particular king professing a religion, he is already proclaiming himself to have certain rights within the hierarchy of return to Jerusalem and everything else, because most kings of that era were kings by divine providence. And if you look through the Christian world, you know, the king of the Sun King Louis was there by God's own graces. And they were sanctioned by the Vatican and given validity through their religious affiliation. And so I don't think that period in the Khazaria region was any different.
Indeed, in fact, even more so, because the kings, obviously, of Khazaria started to look like King David and King Solomon, especially having these big armies and trampling all over the people, all over the place, and taxing the Vikings and taxing everybody who tried to do business through them. They had this aura. They managed to pull this aura, and they kept that going, and that became part of their understanding of Judaism. And what then happened was that, sort of like you're saying, push the clock on a bit, and we find ourselves in the 17th century under a man called Shabbatai Zevi, who spawned what was the largest messianic movement in the last 2,000 years among the Jews. I mean, he was massive. It was a very messianic century. Because the year 1666 was on its way, the Christians thought Jesus was coming back. And there was a particular date which was auspicious in the Jewish calendar, where a lot of people thought it may be the date of the return of the Messiah. And this guy, Shabbatai Zevi, he was alive at that time. He was a renowned Kabbalist.
One of the interesting facts that I want to start finishing up with, because what we've decided to do because of the enormity of this subject is to take this particular subject into a couple of segments, because it is a great deal of information, and we do want people to be able to make their own inquiries if they're interested, or look into the things that we're claiming to be. And of course, the book that much of our information comes from is on my website at IamTheWitness.com. So, Muhammad, what could you say the next phase of our discussions, possibly tomorrow, would be about in regards to this?
Yes, well, I agree with you, Darryl. The thing that we're trying to cover here for the listeners out there is obviously 3,000 years of history almost, and we're trying to encapsulate it as best we can. What we need to look into, Darryl, from this are what are the implications of this history today?
Right.
And also, how did it develop? And what are the implications of those developments?
Because this religious stuff has turned into a geopolitical, a modern-day geopolitical question, hasn't it?
Indeed. We went from Eretz Israel, the expression, the love of Israel, how we would expect religious Jews to want to go back into God's favour. They want to, the diaspora to end, but now we've got a group of guys who are saying, hey, I'm not waiting for God. Let's not wait for God. We're going to make this happen ourselves. And it's about how that came about and whether there is, because we know the Christians give a lot of support to this, whether there is evidence for support for this in the Bible, or whether as Christians they should actually be opposing it.
Well, I agree with you, and I know the second half of the story. That's why I can tell you now that I already agree with that statement. Ladies and gentlemen, Muhammad has done a great job of serializing the story. I mean, this is not all cited, but when you go to Mr. Kussler's work, Arthur Kussler, you will get cited explanations, and you will go to the indexing pages, and it is cited from front to back. It is a scholarly work, but there are other books that we will make available over time for you to cross-reference this information and do further study, even beyond what we are discussing here on the French Connection. And what you must understand is the reasons why we believe this is very important, and we will talk about this tomorrow, is that certain groups of offshoots of these groups we're discussing today have actually declared a Messiah. And we will discuss, you know, what the implications of that geopolitically are, and just how the people are putting together this messianic plan. I mean, it's a plan. It's treachery, but it's a plan, and it's a frightful one. I don't want to cast any dispersions here, but it's pretty treacherous when you take a look at it. So these are the goals that we're going to have. We're going to set for the French Connection's next look at this. And I want to thank you, Muhammad, for coming on today. This has been a real education, and you are a great resource, sir, and I hope to be having this same conversation with you tomorrow.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Daryl.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Muhammad Rafiq is a Londoner. He is a very well-educated man on these subjects, and as you will see tomorrow, we do have important questions to discuss that have implications for both the United States and for the rest of the world. There, some of the questions we're going to raise are frightening. Others of them we're not sure how all of this is going to play out. One sure thing here is that something is happening quite important right now in this community. And they are exercising all of their efforts to bring something to the fore here, and it has something to do with Iraq and the war there, and Iran and the war there, and the undermining of the Syrian government, and it has something to do with different powerful groups within the Ashkenazi sect, and even infighting amongst them. And we'll talk about all of those things tomorrow. I'm proud to have people like Muhammad bring his knowledge to this show. I always try to make my investigations as honest as I can. There is no interest from me to be anti-Semitic or even anti-Khazarian. I want to be pro-truth and anti-criminal, ladies and gentlemen, and that is my goal. Please stick with us here on the French Connection for all of the facts so that you know what's happening in our world. Thanks again, and I will be back with you tomorrow.